Hello and welcome to the PCJ Media Archives. I'm Keith Parent. Someone who's been a guest on the Happy Station show a few times is David Monson. Now, in case you're not familiar with David, for many years he was the host of Brussels Calling on Belgian Radio International. Upon leaving Belgium, he found his way to Namibia and working as an announcer-producer with the Southwest African Broadcasting Corporation, now known as the Namibian Broadcasting Corporation. We now present an edition of Thursday at 8, a program that David did at the SWABC. Listen carefully, because at the beginning you'll hear another well-known voice in international broadcasting circles. That is of Jeff White. Jeff is the founder and owner of Radio Miami International, that's WRMI, in the United States. Jeff was SWABC's man in Chicago and called in with a report about bad blizzards in the area. The exact date of this program is unknown, but Jeff and David both told me it's from the early 1980s.
News, views, and counterviews in Thursday at 8.
Good evening from me, David Monson, and welcome to yet another Thursday at 8. In this edition, we'll be hearing about devastating winter weather in the United States, about the theft of priceless exhibits in the collection at the Alte Feste, and later we'll be talking to the cultural historian responsible for textiles about the museum's collection of costume. Winston Lawden will report on the rumbling that could just become a roar as Mount Etna threatens to blow its top again. And we'll hear about the makings of a volcano. I'll also be chatting to a recent visitor to Southwest Africa and Namibia, none other than the BBC's David Attenborough, filming in the Namib for his new natural history series, scheduled for television screening in 1984. All that in Thursday at 8, so stay put.
Can you believe it? She actually stopped me in the middle of the supermarket to ask what I was going to do with so much tastic rice. I mean, can you bear it?
Well, she obviously doesn't know.
Obviously, but I told her. I said, Ange, anybody who's anybody buys simply mounds of tastic these days, because at only 4 cents a serving, it's become the inflation fighter that's all the rage. Well, you should have seen her face.
I can imagine.
Tonight, a tastic night.
Tastic cooks perfectly every time.
Whether your taste is for beef tartare with caviar, grilled mackerel, or veal and almond with spinach sauce, celebrate your taste with a very dry Grünberger. Blanc de Blanc. Very noble. Very different. Very, very dry. Blanc de Blanc. The very dry Grünberger.
But first, Bill Franklin with the news headlines.
Angola has accused South Africa of attacking Cuban and Angolan troops deep inside Angola and of escalating the conflict with long-range air raids. It said the Cuban soldiers had not been killed and captured near the border, as reported by South Africa, but 320 kilometers inside the country. Anti-terrorist police squads raided homes in several parts of Dublin today, hunting terrorists who tried to assassinate Ireland's top police forensic scientist, Dr. James Donovan. Police headquarters reported no arrests. He received severe leg injuries in a booby-trapped car bomb yesterday. Roman Catholic bishops in France and West Germany today called for the lifting of martial law in Poland and the freeing of thousands of people being detained by the military authorities in the country. They promised their moral and material support in every respect to the church in Poland. 5 Solidarity leaders in Poland have been sentenced to prison terms of between 3 and 6.5 years, and their civil rights have been suspended for between 2 and 4 years for allegedly organizing illegal strikes and publishing outlawed communiques and calling for a continuation of strikes. The Karakul pelt offer for the first London auction in the second week of next month is more than 50% down on last year and more than 60% below that of 1980, but quality is reported to be up.
Thank you, Bill. Inclement winter weather is nothing unusual at this time of the year in northern climes. But this year, it's been more inclement than usual, with storms and blizzards sweeping across the United States and leaving a trail of disaster in their swath. As we hear from our man on the spot, Jeff White, in Chicago.
The rain is gone now from Northern California, but the threat of the killer mudslides persists, and the death toll from the state's worst storm in decades continues to mount. The casualty toll along 150 miles of the Northern California coast stands at 25 dead and 12 missing. Hit hardest by the 2 days of heavy rains were wealthy Marin County north of San Francisco and Santa Cruz County on Monterey Bay. 9 people are confirmed dead, mostly in mudslides in Santa Cruz County alone. At daybreak today, relief crews started pushing through knee-deep mud and overturned trees toward the Love Creek area, where a mudslide 2 miles long buried several houses. Authorities believe the slide may have buried as many as 10 people. Area roads are choked with boulders, mud, trees, and refrigerators from destroyed houses on the hill above. In Marin County, mudslides sent 2 homes crashing down the hills above Sausalito, killing 1 woman. Slides also closed a detour route which had allowed the temporary reopening of the Golden Gate Bridge. About 600 people have now been evacuated from Sausalito for fear of more slides. And in the city of Pacifica, workers today found the body of the 3rd of 3 children buried when mudslides smashed 2 houses. Preliminary estimates put Northern California property losses at more than $100 million. Much of it suffered by homeowners not insured against the rare flood and mudslide damage. President Reagan says the federal government stands ready to provide assistance to California. However, the White House says it has not yet received a formal request for help from Governor Jerry Brown. A spokesman for Brown says the governor is waiting for a thorough assessment before requesting federal aid, probably in 2 or 3 days. The storm that killed at least 28 people in Northern California is now spreading its misery eastward. Parts of northern Montana had a high temperature today of 18 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, and Nebraska had 6 inches of snow plus bitter cold. The happy exceptions are ski areas in the Rocky Mountains, which got several more inches of white gold on the slopes. Here in the Midwest, temperatures are very cold, but they're a bit better than last week when severe blizzards hit many cities in this part of the country. The snow has subsided here in the Chicago area, but the temperatures are still quite cold, as Dale Helgerson of the suburban Rockford Weather Office told us.
It's been a very cold morning. We just hit 9 below at the airport here in Rockford, and there's pretty much the same story across all the upper Midwest, up in northwest Minnesota. Got up down as low as 25 below, and there should be a gradual warming trend the next couple days. It'll still be quite cold yet tonight, but starting about tomorrow, we're expecting a warming trend, getting high in the low 20s.
The 20-year-old man survived 4 days in a wrecked van in the western Oklahoma cold after setting his broken legs with a screwdriver and rolled up newspapers. The storms that have hit the country since the first of the year are now blamed for at least 94 deaths nationwide. For SWABC, this is Jeff White in Chicago.
Back home here in southwest Africa, Namibia, we've had our own series of summer disasters. There's the ongoing drought conditions that, if it doesn't rain soon, could just find us all panting for water. There have been the power cuts, and no one's yet been able to come up with an estimate as to what the intermittent blackouts cost the country. There's also been a theft of international proportions, if you can call it that. Visitors to southwest Africa, Namibia, are alleged to have made off with 2 priceless items in the collection at the Alta Vista. On the line to our studios, Chief Detective Superintendent Collins of the Windhoek CID.
Well, according to the information we've got to our disposal, the items consist of a flag which has the swastika on it. There's also a, well, I suppose it would be some kind of a tunic, and a blind which measures 2 meters by 1 meter. I don't know what it was supposed to function as, but it's called a blind, which had the German eagle on it.
And 2 of these items at least have been described as priceless pieces of, well, textile.
Yeah, I see they haven't mentioned the value here, so I'm a bit at a loss to be able to support that. But I imagine they would be fairly valuable, yeah.
Now, have we made any, or have you folk at the CID, have you got on to anybody yet, or any clues? Do you think that these articles have actually been removed from the country, Superintendent Collins?
Well, at this stage, the newspapers are speculating on a certain suspect, but we've got no definite information that any particular person was in fact involved in this theft, and consequently we can't even tell you whether these items have in fact been removed from the country or whether they're still here.
Of course, if they have been taken abroad, this means you were getting Interpol onto the chase.
Well, I suppose we will approach foreign authorities to try and help us in recovering the items. I mean, you know, this is a pretty complicated system through which one has to work, and we'll have to map these things out when we get there.
Of course, this sort of thing is nothing new for you. I mean, the fact that a few items of textiles have been removed from the Altavesta might be a sort of new, might be another innovation, but a variation on a theme, as it were. But of course, you people at the CID are fairly used, I suppose, to valuable commodities. I'm thinking of diamonds and what have you, not being removed from the country and having to chase them up.
Well, you see, because of the fact that these things have got cultural history which is attached to a foreign country as such, I suppose that we will get a bit of assistance from overseas in connection with this matter, and I've got a reasonable amount of faith that if it is, in fact, overseas, or if they are overseas, the authorities there will help us trace them.
One sort of wonders why anybody would want to, swipe these particular items.
Well, you know, there are people who've got certain interests in historic items for personal reasons, and I mean, I've already found that there are people who've got a fanatic interest in anything that bears the swastika. Mm-hmm. I suppose it has its origin in the new way of neo-Nazism that has sort of stuck its head out overseas. So I suppose that there can be some or other reason why a person would be interested in these things.
Mm-hmm. So you don't really think that these folk will try and sell these items abroad? You think it's more a personal interest?
In all probability. I mean, this is only wild speculation. You see, we don't know exactly what his motives were, but you know, things like this are actually difficult to sell because the buyers usually query the origin and they try and trace the persons from whom these items were purported to have been received just to make sure that if they should ever display them, they won't get into trouble. And this is one of the things people selling them will have to consider.
Hmm. So in actual fact, if they did try and sell them, they would be very easily traceable.
I'm pretty confident, yes.
Chief Detective Superintendent Collins of the Vintok CID.
This is the story of the king's new clothes. Now, there was once a king who was absolutely insane about new clothes, and one day, two swindlers came to sell him what they said was a magic suit of clothes. Now, they held up this particular garment, and they said, "Your Majesty, this is a magic suit." Well, the truth of the matter is, there was no suit there at all. But the swindlers were very smart. And they said, "Your Majesty, to a wise man, this is a beautiful raiment. But to a fool, it is absolutely invisible." Well, naturally, the king, not wanting to appear a fool, said, "Isn't it grand? Isn't it fine? Look at the cut, the style, the line. The suit of clothes is altogether, but altogether, it's altogether the most remarkable suit of clothes that I have ever seen. These eyes of mine at once determined, the sleeves are velvet, the cape is ermine, the hose are blue, and the doublet is a lovely shade of green.
Lovely shade of green."
Somebody send for the queen. Well, they sent for the queen, and they quickly explained to her about the magic suit of clothes. And naturally, the queen, not wanting to appear a fool, said, "Well, isn't it all, isn't it rich? Look at the charm of every stitch. The suit of clothes is altogether, but altogether, it's altogether the most remarkable suit of clothes that I have ever seen. These eyes of mine at once determined, the sleeves are velvet, the cape is ermine, the hose are blue, and the doublet is a lovely shade of green.
Lovely shade of green."
Summon the court to convene. Well, the court convened, and you never in your life saw as many people as were at that court. All the ambassadors, the dukes, the earls, the counts, it was just black with people. And they were all told about the magic suit of clothes. And after they were told, they naturally didn't want to appear fools, and they said, "Isn't it all, isn't it all, isn't it absolutely the suit of clothes is altogether, but altogether, it's altogether the most remarkable suit of clothes."
Well, never mind the king's new clothes. We sincerely hope the cops will catch up with the robbers that have made off with those exhibits in the Altavesta's collection. Of course, the theft of these textiles should highlight what is, and has become, under the guidance of cultural historian Martelina Brandt, a highly prized collection, that of costume and textiles at the Altarfeste.
I must say that I've come here and there were only very few items. We've got over 400 items in the collection at the present moment, and most of them have been collected over the past two and a half years.
That's incredible. Over 400. Costumes not exactly on display, though. I had hoped to be able to do this interview with you, you know, be able to wander around the collection and refer to different items and have you describe them for me. But this is not going to be possible, simply because most of those exhibits are all tucked away in boxes. Well, the boxes I see here?
Yes, they're right. Well, you see, textiles are very fragile items. They're not supposed to be displayed. Not very much, because light is harmful to textiles. And touching, one doesn't like touching them, and it's a terrific task cleaning textiles. And once you've got them so far that they've been restored or conserved, they're packed away and touched as little as possible, and as little light as possible.
But nevertheless, I would have thought you would try, or you would be working towards possibly putting them on a permanent display so that members of the public can come along and see them.
It is quite true that we change our textile display every third or fourth year. We have a couple of items on display, and we are hoping to increase them in due time when we give a little more money and a little more room for display. You know, display cabinets are very expensive. Mm-hmm. And it's hard work. I mean, in a cultural historian's mm-hmm. life, there is very little time to devote to each section. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it's a very time-depriving section, the textiles.
I should imagine also this climate is not very kind to costume or the preservation of costume.
Yes. Well, I don't agree with
textiles,
you.
Textiles, I mean.
Yes. Well, no, on the contrary, I'm in a very, very lucky situation, because a dry climate is advantageous. You see, a damp climate is very disadvantageous to textile preservation. In our climate, we only have to guard against dust, because dust is injurious to fibers. So we try to protect our textiles as much as possible.
Of course, there's enough of that in the air,
yes.
too. I think it goes almost without saying that most of the costume here in your collection is actually originates locally. Not made locally, necessarily, but originates locally.
Yes, definitely Southwest African. I've only got about 30 to 35, well, let us say, on the whole, about 50 items which have not been worn in Southwest Africa, but or partly, or perhaps just brought with the pioneers and been kept in family hands and then finally handed to the museum.
Maybe some of you have lived through, or with, at some stage of your life, that sound, the sound of an erupting volcano. In Italy, Mount Etna appears to be building up a head of steam again, belching black smoke into the air and rumbling like a subway tunnel. The last eruption of Mount Etna was in March last year, and experts say it's still too early to determine whether she'll blow it up again. A report from Winston Lawton.
Tremendous damage resulted from last year's eruption, and scientists agree that potentially dangerous volcanoes have to be monitored worldwide to prevent large-scale disasters. The problem is that there are between 600 and 800 volcanic structures around the world, and there are simply just not enough experts, or volcanologists as they're called. Dr. John Tomlinson of the Office of the United Nations Disaster Relief Corps tells us what the experts are doing.
The science of volcanology began almost as a hobby for people who took an interest in this particular aspect of nature, and who began to document what was happening, who took photos. Volcanoes are very photogenic. Their eruptions look spectacular on film. But volcanology has come a long way since those early days. We've developed a social responsibility above all. In earlier days, there was a kind of fatalistic attitude about various natural hazards, of which volcanic eruptions are one, that we couldn't really do anything about it. When an eruption was going to happen, it would happen, and if it was a large one, a certain number of people would get killed. We can do something about it, and the science of volcanology, like many other applied sciences, involves collecting knowledge and using that knowledge. It's a bit like meteorology, like forecasting the weather, except that the total number of observations of at least large eruptions that we've made historically is rather small. A volcano is a hole in the ground, a vent through which molten rock comes to the surface. It's not only a molten liquid material, the liquid contains, in many cases, a great deal of gas. When the gas and the liquid are together underground, the gas occupies very little space. It's rather like the material in a champagne bottle before you take out the cork. Sometimes, when you take out the cork, the liquid may be without much gas. Sometimes, if the champagne is in good condition, there will be a lot of gas. The mixture of liquid and gas will break through at the surface, and if there's a lot of gas, the activity, the eruption, will be an explosive one. If there's liquid and only a little gas, the activity will involve lava flows. The material wells up to the surface and flows down the mountainside, down the valleys, and we have a mild eruption. So for each volcano which represents a threat to nearby populations if it were to erupt, we are trying to compile a dossier by looking first of all at the nature of the historic eruptions. There may be only one or two in many cases. In plenty of cases, there will be no historic eruption at all. At least we can contribute to saving the people and the portable property if we can give warning at the right time, if we can hold back the evacuation until things look really bad. We can also do a service in that we're saving on the duration of the evacuation. We're not trying to prescribe, and we don't believe that it would be possible to have one uniform type of procedure that would work all around the world. But we are very conscious of the fact that there have been serious difficulties, there's been tremendous expenditure, there have been major political confrontations, nothing less than that, which have emerged from uncertainties over the way of dealing with a volcanic emergency. And we're trying to prevent the number of situations where things go badly wrong for want of some basic planning and awareness of the type of problem.
Well, you might have recognized the sound of a volcano, but did you recognize that of a whistling gecko? Of course, you're more likely to see the almost ubiquitous gecko in the Namib Desert than the very rare, and to say the least, rather shy, golden mole. The BBC's David Attenborough and his team were more fortunate than most during their recent visit to Southwest Africa, Namibia, where they came to film for a new natural history series Attenborough hopes to have completed by 1984. I spoke to him at Windhoek Airport just before he took off for Johannesburg en route to London.
I was rather intrigued to know, actually, whether you'd caught up with your golden mole last night.
Well, we didn't indeed have a golden mole, but the reason is thanks to Mary Seeley, who's director of the Research Institute, who actually caught it, and to Rodney Boland, who actually caught a little baby a few days earlier. Mm. So that we are lucky enough to have seen
what, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the rarest of animals. Not because it's rare in numbers in any particular place, but because it's hardly ever seen. I've never seen even a good photograph of it. I don't know whether you have, Andrew.
Rodney has managed to film the golden mole before, and he was very keen to try a second time because he knew the tricks, he knew the problems, he thought he could do better. But what was particularly interesting to us was to find the baby, which he, and as far as we know, nobody has ever seen before. So we have left him with the golden mole, and we hope that he and his wife, Maura, will look after it hour by hour, literally, because it has to be fed every hour because it's still weaning. And if they can get through that stage, they will get some very special film that we're really looking forward to seeing.
So you've quite literally left him with the baby, carrying the can out here, while you return to England. Of course, you didn't only come out here to the Narmad to film the Golden Mole. You filmed everything, I should imagine, from the Golden Mole to those living fossils of Welwitschia, not so difficult to catch if you know where to find them, of course.
That's true. But we're not actually making a film about the Narmad. We're making a series of films about the various different kinds of countries in the world, I mean, the kind of ecosystems. And there is one film which is entirely about deserts, for example, and which not only covers but compares the Namib and the Sahara and the Central Australian Desert and the Atacama Desert, looking at all the characteristics and plants and animals which are the result of living in a desert environment. So we wanted a few very particular things from the Namib, of which, as you say, the golden mole and Welwitschia were too.
Yeah. Well, making a series like this must require one enormous budget.
The answer to that is no. It doesn't require an enormous budget. What we try to do is, as I said earlier, to make all the programs at once. We would research them. We would decide that we have to go to a particular place at a particular time for one film. That goes on the large wall chart. So we then say to the other producers, and there are three working on the series, that we have to go to that place. What do you want from the programs you're making that could be done in that place? So we only have to go once for a variety of purposes. So that in the end, when you see the series, within each particular program, we may well cover five continents. That looks expensive. But taken over the whole series, we've only been to each continent, as it were, once, to film, to research, to find out about everything that's related to the series. So although it seems to cost a lot of money, we think it's good value.
But apart from that, if you're judged by the last series, which was Life on Earth, in point of fact, it didn't cost the British licence payer anything because so many countries bought it when it was finished that the cost of BBC nothing.
There once was an ugly duckling with feathers all stubby and brown. And the other birds in so many words said, get out of town. Get out, get out, get out of town. And he went with a quack and a waddle and a quack in a flurry of eiderdown. That poor little ugly duckling went wandering far and near, but at every place they said to his face, now get out of here. Get out, get out, get out of here. And he went with a quack and a waddle and a quack and a very unhappy tear.
Yes, well, we can't all be as beautiful as the golden mole, but, you know, there's room enough for all of us. So, with our television men up in the air and golden moles back underground, it's time for us on the Thursday at 8 team to do the same. That's until it's Tuesday at 8 next week. So, from me, David Monson, and our controller tonight, Robin Wise, it's good night. And, incidentally, if you have a golden mole in the back garden, let me know about it.
To show his face, afraid of what others might say, All through the winter in his lonely clump of weed, till a flock of swans spied him there and very soon agreed, you're a very fine swan.
If you would like to hear more of these historic broadcasts, let us know. Our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. That's pcjmedia@gmail.com. And good listening, everyone.